believe that there's a reasonable degree of risk that's involved in this?
Well, this is what South Korea has decided to do along its border with the North. We will explore that. This is Thursday, August 23rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Remember, you can join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, almost a year ago, Rohingya refugees went to Bangladesh, and they still see no clear way home. Ongoing talks between the U.S. and Washington are not being given the highest expectations, and some Pakistani boat workers might have more security on the job than they do in their lives. All on today's VOA Asia. The commander of U.S. forces in South Korea, General Vincent Brooks, said Wednesday that while nuclear diplomacy with North Korea may be successful, Washington must continue applying pressure so that there is not a reason for even the ability for the North to back off. Speaking at the Seoul Foreign Correspondents Club, Brooks said he generally supports a pullback from some outpost along the demilitarized zone dividing the Koreas.
I have some concerns about what that means militarily to the ability to defend along the military demarcation line and in depth beyond it. And I believe that there's a reasonable degree of risk that's involved in this, not an excessive amount of risk as a combined forces commander to the defense of the Republic of Korea.
Brooks said the chances for a diplomatic breakthrough with Pyongyang are better now because of new governments in both Seoul and Washington, and because the threat posed by the North's missile and nuclear programs has never been greater. His comments followed a statement by the UN atomic watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which warned it has found no indication that the North has stopped its nuclear buildup. It said the continuation and further development of the North's nuclear program and related statements is a cause for grave concern. In a Reuters interview Monday, President Donald Trump said he believed the North had taken specific steps toward denuclearization, and he would most likely meet again with Kim Jong-un as he did in Singapore in June. RAND Corporation senior defense analyst Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty the North appears to be separating plutonium for use in nuclear weapons and producing highly enriched uranium.
They're concerned that there's evidence that despite Kim's claim that he's prepared to denuclearize, that he hasn't even been freezing his force, let alone denuclearizing. He's actually been nuclearizing. He's probably built 5 to 8 nuclear weapons so far this year, and that's not good.
Is it a cause for grave concern, as the IAEA said?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. President Trump agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un because Kim Jong-un said he was going to abandon his nuclear weapons. This is a classical North Korea bait and switch. Kim Jong-un promised one thing. He's now refusing to do any kind of denuclearization. And after his meeting in Singapore, he went home to North Korea, and according to several sources I have, he's briefed the senior elites that he was never going to give up his nuclear weapons, that they were key to regime survival. President Trump probably would have never met with him unless he offered to abandon his nuclear weapons. Now he's reneging. That's a concern because it looks like he's going to keep building. And that then pushes the U.S. into some escalated response against him.
Mr. Trump, in an interview Monday with Reuters, said he believed the North had taken specific steps toward denuclearization, and he would, quote unquote, most likely meet again with the North Korean leader. Is that a little premature?
Well, I don't think it's premature. I think Trump is trying to give Kim Jong-un every opportunity to prove that he's prepared to do this. If in the end Kim Jong-un refuses to do what he's promised to do, then President Trump can say, okay, now we've got to do something more serious because a North Korea with hundreds of nuclear weapons is something we will not accept. He's going to give Kim every opportunity, but eventually Kim's going to wear out the possibilities.
The U.S. on Tuesday announced more sanctions, this time on 2 Russian shipping companies and 6 vessels it said are involved in the transfer of refined petroleum products to North Korean vessels in violation of international sanctions.
I think that if the administration's done that, they've got photo evidence of those ships. They can clearly demonstrate that those ships have done that. And they're probably waiting for the Russians to say several times that no, they didn't. So then the administration can come out and say, looks like you guys aren't telling us the truth. Here's the photo evidence. It's a lot like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, said, no, we're not doing that. And then the photo evidence demonstrated that they were. So I think the Trump administration is trying to play a solid hand, and Russia just doesn't want to be caught in their bad behavior.
Meanwhile, the South Korean news agency Wednesday said South Korea hopes next month's planned third inter-Korean summit this year in Pyongyang will set the pace of denuclearization. No date has been set for the summit, which may follow a fourth trip to North Korea by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. We are inviting you now to read more on our top story. Follow us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Kabul says no Taliban. Kabul says no. The Taliban say yes to Moscow-hosted Afghan peace talks. Singapore-born novelist Kevin Kwan, whose book inspired the new Hollywood hit film Crazy Rich Asians, is wanted in the city-state for failing to register for national service. Hundreds of Korean family members reunite after being separated for more than six decades since the Korean War said their goodbyes on Wednesday. And Chinese President Xi Jinping says the internet must be clean and righteous. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Rohingya Muslims Wednesday marked Eid al-Adha, the Islamic festival of sacrifice, almost a year since a military crackdown in Myanmar, also known as Burma, forced them to flee to Bangladesh. A day earlier, Myanmar de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi told an audience in Singapore that terrorism triggered the crackdown.
The danger of terrorist activities, which was the initial cause of events leading to the humanitarian crisis in Rakhine, remains real and present today. Unless this security challenge is addressed, the risk of intercommunal violence will remain. It is a threat that could have grave consequences, not just for Myanmar, but also for other countries in our region and beyond.
She also said the repatriation of the Rohingya back to Rakhine State must be decided by both her government and Bangladesh. The two countries last year signed an agreement to repatriate the Rohingya, but its implementation has stalled.
It's very difficult for us to put a time frame on it by ourselves unilaterally, because we have to work with Bangladesh in order to do that. So a time frame can be decided only by our two countries working together. The IDPs have to be sent back by Bangladesh. The returnees have to be sent back by Bangladesh. And we can only welcome them at the border. That is part of our agreement.
The plight of the Rohingya, including accounts of murder, torture, rape, and a burning of villages, has been likened to ethnic cleansing resulting in international sanctions. Don Weatherby, distinguished professor emeritus at the University of South Carolina, told Victor Beatty that Bangladesh is not holding up the repatriation process.
Bangladesh has no reason to hold it up. The issue is actually the logistics and the willingness of the Rohingya who are now in Bangladesh to return without guarantees of security on the Myanmar side.
Aung San Suu Kyi seemed to defend the military, saying that the government is trying to combat terrorism. She says, we who are living through the transition in Myanmar view it differently from those who observe it from the outside and who will remain untouched from its outcome. There have been a lot of sanctions and call for sanctions directed at the military. Are those sanctions unjustified?
It depends on what level of political action you're thinking about. Aung San Suu Kyi has to balance the international community and what the international community expects of her, which is more than she can deliver, to the fact that the transition from the military rule to a fully democratic civilian government has not been completed. The concern is that to sanction Myanmar would disturb her ability to continue to deal internally in a dialogue which has been going on for years with the senior military in terms of the pace and direction of internal political change.
Her speech marked 2 years in power. Have things changed in your view in Myanmar since Aung San Suu Kyi came to power?
Certainly it's changed. You can see the change in the country, the lifting of sanctions, the economic progress that is being made, the reforms that are taking place, the optimism that people have. Change is taking place, but the change does not take place overnight. Eventually, the constitution will be changed. The dominance of the military will slowly be reduced. And the international community, I think, has to have historical patience. I think they expect too much of her. They think that she is the last decision maker. She has to negotiate this internally with the military. She is constrained by the political forces within the country, which are giving way to, I call her, vision. But it's still going to be a while before we can say the transition is completed.
Don Weatherby likens events in Myanmar to what occurred in Indonesia, where that military's influence dominated politics and the process to a civil democracy is still not complete nearly 20 years later. He said sanctions now will only hurt efforts by moderate forces in Myanmar to complete the country's transition. Happening now in Asia, more than 400 people have died since heavy rain hit Kerala in India in recent weeks, triggering deadly landslides and submerging entire villages as rivers burst their banks. A report says English-speaking artificial intelligence robots will be helping out in some 500 Japanese classrooms starting next year as that country seeks to improve its English skills among both children and teachers. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VO Asia. We appreciate you being with us on VOA Asia. Mid-level talks continue here in Washington between the United States and China. These talks come on the eve of additional U.S. tariffs being placed on some $16 billion worth of Chinese goods, with China threatening to match the U.S. moves. We welcome to VOA Asia Phil Levy. Phil is the Senior Fellow on the Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. As these trade talks are going on between the U.S. and China, President Trump told Reuters in an interview his expectations were not high at all. Here, something quite different, at least from some people on the Chinese end of things, saying that they hoped something was going to happen. In your view, where do these talks stand and where does the situation stand?
I think that the Trump administration has seemed very determined to go ahead with its tariffs and to expand those tariffs. I think China has made a number of serious efforts to try to negotiate a sort of climb down from this conflict. I think there's been mounting domestic pressure on the Trump administration to at least look like it's trying to reach a deal, and that's how we should interpret these talks. This is the Trump administration trying to look like they're going to reach a deal. I don't think, if you go back and you look at what happened in May when Vice Premier Liu He came to Washington and held what seemed to be successful talks directly with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and that failed, the odds that this succeeds at the vice ministerial level seem rather slim.
Do you think the tariffs, especially increased tariffs, will do anything to ease this situation in any way, shape, or form ever?
No, I think the tariffs are going to be counterproductive. I think that China has certainly expressed a strong interest in finding out how this might be resolved, and I think one of the real problems with the administration's diplomacy on this front is they have not made clear to the Chinese just what it is they're asking for. And I think in part that's because there is no consensus within the administration or even clarity perhaps in the president's mind about what it is they are seeking through this confrontation.
Let's go back to before Donald Trump became president of the United States. He has always talked about tariffs as the way to go. And he said, well, you know, he has run big businesses and that's the way the government should carry out its international business. Does that work?
No, I think that analogy was always flawed. I think he ran a very particular kind of business. Not one that, for example, engaged in trade in intermediate goods and had to worry about such things. It was not a giant conglomerate. It was very much a family business. So I don't think the analogy works. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can listen to what, say, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is saying with sort of millions of members, and they are roundly denouncing this and saying that tariffs do not work.
Who are the tariffs going to hurt?
The tariffs are going to hurt your average American who purchases things. They're going to hurt U.S. standing in the world and our ability to shape world rules. And they're going to hurt American businesses who use imported parts. And they're going to hurt American farmers and businesses who tried to sell goods to China. All of them are going to get hurt.
Any way to fix the situation?
I think that the United States needs to get serious about what its objectives are. There are some very real concerns about Chinese economic behavior. On that part, the president is correct. But the U.S. needs to get some focus and prioritization. It needs to be able to separate out the kind of critiques which are completely unfounded economically, focusing on things like bilateral trade deficits, and instead turn to the more serious matters such as intellectual property protection and take a more constructive approach. How we get there with this president is less clear.
That is Phil Levy, Senior Fellow in the Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. The tariffs that President Trump placed against China are a response to an investigation in which the administration accused China of bolstering its own technological and economic development by forcefully transferring valuable technology owned by U.S. companies. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is facing another challenge to his leadership of the Conservative Liberal Party. Hardline Conservative Peter Dutton told a Melbourne radio station Wednesday that he's seeking support from his colleagues to take on the embattled Turnbull. The challenge to the leadership comes as recent voter opinion surveys show the Liberal Party lagging far behind the opposition Labor Party ahead of parliamentary elections scheduled for May. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. The Pakistani coastal town of Gadani in the outskirts of Karachi is one of the largest ship demolition yards in the world. It's a very dangerous place to work. In November of 2016, more than two dozen workers were killed when a decommissioned oil tanker caught fire. This report, produced in Pakistan for VOA's Urdu service, looks at the challenges workers face every day in Gadani. Behzad Hamdard has more.
When ships outlive their usefulness, they are brought to coastal yards, like this one in Gadani, where more than 100 ships are demolished each year for parts and raw materials.
The reason why only four places in the world can be used for dismantling ships is because not every coastal body of water is deep enough. Gadani waters meet those ship-breaking requirements.
It takes 30 to 40 days to dismantle a ship. Aside from the long hours, the work can be dangerous. Workers in the billion-dollar industry are often victims of accidents due to inadequate gear or training. The entire work involves metal structures. Explosions can occur, as I am sure you have heard and seen in the news. Two or three people die here every month.
It is a very hard and difficult job. When we leave our homes in the morning, we always think about whether we will return or not.
A major accident here in November 2016 killed 26 workers and injured 60. Since then, workers say nothing has been done to improve working conditions.
The wealthy owners here have made this job even more dangerous because there are no safety measures being taken. However, we have no other option except continuing working here because we have to make both ends meet. We are poor. If we refuse to work in these conditions, they will throw us out.
But the shipyard's owner insists safety standards are monitored and all workers are properly trained. He adds that both the government and the business owners must be held accountable for worker safety.
Government must facilitate this. They are taking a good revenue from this industry. Secondly, our own shipbreaking association can also take responsibility. We too can take development measures. And honestly, it isn't that big of an issue.
Ship demolition is not only hazardous for workers, it is also becoming a challenge for sea life and people who live nearby. Debris is dumped in the ocean and airborne chemicals have caused respiratory problems. That's a continuing worry for residents and the 12,000 workers whose livelihood depends on the ship demolition yard. Bejan Hamdar, VOA News, Washington.
Now on VOA Asia, population growth and rising sea levels will increase pressure on our farmlands to grow more food. However, one British design graduate is hoping to combat that sobering trend with her concept of a floating farm at sea. VOA's Julie Tabo has more on that.
Layla Clark may be on the verge of revolutionizing ancient agricultural practices. The British design graduate has created a prototype for a floating farm that she hopes will allow people to grow vegetables at sea. Her scaled-down model uses evaporation to provide fresh water inside the dome structure.
The basic idea is this sits in the water. Water comes up inside the inside plant area. Then the condensation will rise, land on the domes outside, so the plants get fed the pure water.
The natural desalination process means there's no need for expensive pumps or filtration systems. And as the weather gets hotter, more water evaporates. The higher the temperature, the better it works.
So this just allows kind of like physics to take care of it. You know, things heat up, they evaporate, they cool down, they condense.
Clark believes such projects will become more necessary in coming years as scientists predict rising sea levels and global temperatures will render formerly fertile farmland less productive. And as the world's population rises, so does the need to grow more food.
So I was kind of wanting to tackle two birds, one stone, like the increased population is going to need more food to support them. And also we're going to need somewhere else to grow our food since the farmland isn't going to be available anymore.
Clark did 2 months of experimentation using various methods to test desalination and plant growth rates in both still and rough waters.
And then actually ended up making my own rig just on a rocking chair with a large glass fish tank, which was actually the best because I could record things the most kind of consistently.
Clark has grown both chard and spinach greens on the device and thinks radishes would also grow well. She hopes to eventually receive commercial funding to scale up the project. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
30 Cambodians who had been living in the United States arrived in Cambodia Wednesday after being deported under a U.S. law that allows the repatriation of immigrants who have been convicted of felonies that have not become American citizens. The group is the latest to be sent to Cambodia. Under a 2002 bilateral agreement, more than 500 other Cambodians have already been repatriated. The program is controversial because it breaks up families. In some cases, the returnees have never lived in Cambodia, having been born to refugees who fled to camps in Thailand to escape the genocidal Khmer Rouge regime that ruled Cambodia. from 1975 to 1979. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you at VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns. Have yourself a wonderful day.